This lesson is from the course, The Theology of Heaven in the Book of Hebrews, taught by Dr. Lane Tipton.
Let me read Hebrews 8, 1-6. Now the point in what we're saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus, it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is much more excellent than the old, as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises. Now, let me make some preliminary comments as we approach this text. First, by way of programmatic theological statement, we need to appreciate that for the author of Hebrews, it is not the incarnation, but the ascension and session of Christ that advances his humanity to beatitude. In the module on Thomas, taught some time ago, we found that in his system of theology, the incarnation perfectly realizes the invisible mission of the Son. In the incarnation, we find the perfect participation of the human nature as it is reproportioned to the divine nature and attains the beatific vision. Thomas himself says, quote, "The whole totality of the divine work is in a manner brought to completion through the incarnation. Since man, who was the last to be created, returns by a certain circular movement to his first principle, united to the very principle of all things through the work of the incarnation." End quote. The visible mission of the incarnation actualizes the term or end of the invisible mission of the Son and the Spirit, which is a graced participation in the essence of God within the Trinitarian processions. If you need to review, check back to those lectures. But in the incarnation, as the Son is united to the principle of all things, the Father, he partakes in the highest form of grace available to the creature and is beatified. Legg, if you remember, comments on this text as follows. "The ultimate consummation of the divine missions is the perfect completion of man's return to God, namely the glory of heaven, in which human beings are united directly to the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in the beatifying vision of God," end quote. And where is that realized for Jesus? In the hypostatic union. In the incarnation, there is a graced participation in the nature of God that elevates that humanity above its nature to participate in the divine. Now, this way of thinking, what I just described, this traditional Roman Catholic way of thinking embedded in Thomas's theology, is foreign to the author of Hebrews and to Reformed theology. In Reformed theology, the emphasis is not on the ontological, the graced participation of the human in the divine nature. It is rather redemptive historical, an advancement of a state. In the resurrection and ascension, Jesus enters into the estate of glory in heaven. It is at the time point of his bodily ascension into heaven that Jesus, in his glorified humanity, attains the perfect completion of man's return to God, not in the incarnation. It is at the time point of his bodily ascension that Jesus, in his glorified humanity, attains the beatific vision. The Reformed theology of the advancement of a state is not found in ontological participation of the elevating of human nature to participate in the divine nature in the incarnation. It is found rather in the advancement of estate, in the translation of the resurrection body into the primordial dwelling place of heaven to behold the glory of God set on display within it as a temple dwelling. The advancement from communion in the estate of innocency to communion in the estate of glory controls the pre-fall situation. The advancement from communion in the estate of grace to communion in the estate of glory controls the post-fall situation. And for the author of Hebrews and for Reformed theology, this advancement of estate is the advancement of covenantal communion, not graced participation in the divine nature. True religion is the advancement of estate. Secondly, in terms of the author's theology of the location of Jesus' high priesthood as ascended, it involves, as I said earlier, both royal and holy aspects of heaven itself. On the one hand, he is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven. And on the other hand, he serves in the true tabernacle made by the Lord, not man. Now, this way of speaking, as I've indicated earlier, unites the themes of heaven as a royal and holy dwelling place. The themes that we treated under the topics of incoronation and indoxation are centered here. But from the vantage point of Hebrews, the regalizing and sanctifying of the temple realm, of the throne dwelling, are functions of the Spirit-endowed mediator entering that domain. He, as the Spirit-endowed King, regalizes heaven as he sits on the throne of the majesty on high. He, as the Spirit-endowed High Priest, sanctifies heaven as he serves as a minister in the true sanctuary made without hands. The regalizing and the sanctifying of the dwelling of God center on the person of Christ as the Spirit-endowed, ascended mediator of the new covenant. And the language there, then, of the throne in heaven and the sanctuary made without hands brings to fulfillment scriptures in the Old Testament that refer to heaven in these ways. For instance, in Psalm 11:4, the Lord is in his holy temple. The Lord's throne is in heaven, is fulfilled in Christ. Do you see it? Or Isaiah 6:1. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Both of those texts find their fulfillment in the ascension of Christ to sit at the right hand of the majesty on high in heaven and to serve in the heavenly sanctuary in heaven. The author of Hebrews takes this Old Testament biblical teaching regarding heaven as the primordial, royal, and holy dwelling place of God, and he frames the high priesthood of Christ in light of it. Third, in light of verses 4 through 5, the reasoning is quite explicit. And reflect on this with me. if Jesus were a high priest on earth, he would not be a priest at all. Do you see that? If Jesus were a priest on earth, he would not be a high priest at all. Why? Because there are those who serve as high priests on earth in a copy and shadow of heaven itself. In verse 4, it is quite explicit. If he were a priest on earth, he would not be a priest at all. Now, this verse presents a hypothetical situation. The grammar here is a second-class condition in Greek, if he were, implying he's not. And it suggests that the author is assuming, for the sake of argument, that Jesus is not in heaven, but instead remains on earth. And in that hypothetical, condition contrary to fact scenario, Jesus would not be a high priest. So it's not that the author is saying Jesus was ever acting as a high priest on the earth in a permanent way. It's rather reasoning on the assumption that the permanent locus of Jesus' high priestly ministry cannot be earthly. It cannot. In fact, if it were, he would not be a priest at all, because the earthly priesthood is defined by the Mosaic Law, which restricts priestly service to the tribe of Levi, especially to the descendants of Aaron. But as Hebrews already points out in 7:13 through 14, Jesus is from the tribe of Judah. And in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. Therefore, Jesus does not meet the legal requirements for the Levitical priesthood at all. Moreover, the author of Hebrews observes that there are priests who offer gifts according to the law in 3 and 4. That clause explains the basis for the assertion that he could not be a priest if he were on earth. What is the conclusion? It's quite simple. Jesus' ministry does not operate according to Mosaic law in the order of Aaron. It operates according to a different principle. Not an earthly, but a heavenly one. If Jesus is a high priest, as he is, and he cannot be a high priest on earth, the only other place where he can be a high priest in the service of the church is in heaven, where he has, in fact, ascended. And that brings us then back, just to reflect for a moment, on verses 1 and 2. We have a high priest seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, the true tent that the Lord set up, and not man. Now, as we move it forward, I want you to look at verse 5. I'm going to spend a little bit of time reflecting on this. Hebrews 8, 5, which conceives of the relation between heaven and the old covenant tabernacle in the following way. The author says that they, high priests on earth, descending from Levi in the Aaronic order, they serve now in the Old Covenant Tabernacle, a copy, a hupadegmati, a copy, and a shadow, skia, of what? Of the things in heaven. So this Old Covenant Tabernacle, according to Hebrews 8:5, this Old Covenant Tabernacle is a copy and a shadow of the things in heaven. Now, here's what we need to appreciate as we begin to move forward in this. The author here is explicit and open that the earthly tabernacle during the time of Moses copied and shadowed what the author in 8:2 calls the true tabernacle made without hands, and what in verse 5 he refers to under the locution of the heavenly original. And the author invokes Exodus 25:40 as the textual basis that establishes the relation between the primordial and heavenly and the secondary and earthly. So we need to raise and ask now this question: how does the author construe this relationship? Well, as we look at it, Gerhardus Voss, in his commentary of sorts, the teaching of the Epistle to the Hebrews, makes the comment that the author of Hebrews expounds, quote, the relation between the content of the first diatheke, the first covenant, and that of the second, namely Old and New Covenants. And the relation is that the Old now prefigures the New. The Old Covenant Tabernacle now, the Old Covenant prefigures what is going to come in the New Covenant. It's a basic notion of prefiguration. The content of the Old Covenant prefigures the content of the New Covenant, and it does so by speaking of the Old as a copy and a shadow of the heavenly reality that will be entered into by Christ in the New Covenant. So the movement is from shadow and copy to what is true and what is heavenly. True, 8:2, heavenly, 8:5. The historical movement from the earthly to the heavenly gets to the core of the progression, the historical progression between Old and New Covenants. Now, this is typically what biblical scholars refer to as typology, the relation of the earthly to the heavenly, vertical, the relation of the past to the future, horizontal. But strictly speaking, then, when we're thinking about this, strictly speaking, if a person or an institution prefigures something that comes later in history, then it anticipates the realization of it. And Voss is talking then about that historical anticipation, that prefiguring that occurs, but he's also thinking vertically. So here's what I want you to think about. Voss tells us that the author of Hebrews, and this is quite clear in Hebrews 8:5, is that there's a twofold relation to the earthly copy and shadow. And let me map it out. There, on the one side, there is what we will call a vertical relation. Then and there, the Old Covenant is a copy and a shadow of a corresponding heavenly reality. So you can think of it this way. The heavenly casts its shadow downward in the Old Covenant under Moses in earthly copies. Yet, at the same time, these earthly copies prefigure the coming and the entrance into the heavenly reality. This is what we will call the horizontal. So what Voss is saying is quite simple. It's very basic. There are two aspects to typology in the book of Hebrews that have to be kept in view at every point. The vertical aspect of the heavenly being shadowed down in earthly copies, and the horizontal aspect of those earthly copies prefiguring the arrival of the heavenly in the coming of Christ in the inauguration of the new covenant. One of the key verses to illustrate the relation that Voss has in view appears in Hebrews 10:1, where the author says this, "For since the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of these realities," and the key Greek word there is eikona, icon, image. It could also be interpreted image. "Because the law has but a shadow of the good things to come, instead of the true form of these realities, it can never, by the same sacrifices that are continually offered year after year, make perfect those who draw near." Now, here's what's so interesting. In that verse, we're just talking now about Hebrews 10:1. You find something quite interesting. The heavenly is an image or eikon or eikona. The earthly is a shadow. What is shadowed down? And when you think of it that way, you have to start to recognize that there's something happening in Hebrews 8:5 that building on preceding Hebrews 10:1 is very unusual. Here's Voss commenting on this language. When the epistle speaks of shadowing, this means a shadowing down from heaven to earth, not a shadowing forward from Old Testament to New Testament. According to this philosophical interpretation, the New Testament is not merely a reproduction of the heavenly reality, but its actual substance, the reality itself, come down from heaven, the eikon, the image itself. The word eikon, which you have in Hebrews 8:5 and Hebrews 10:1, besides meaning image, can also mean archetype. And this is the meaning which precisely suits our purpose here. Let us test the passage with this in mind. And that test passage is Hebrews 8:5. Listen to what Voss says about it. He says, in 8:5, we are told that Jewish priests serve that which is a copy and shadow, hupadegmati and skia. The author adds, it is a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. Thus, it is not a shadow projected or thrown forward into the future, but a shadow cast down from heaven to earth. There's that vertical dimension I talked about earlier. Moreover, the particular use made by the author of the adjective true, alethinos, ought to be noted. Alethinos is much stronger than the word alethes, which is the more common word for true. Alethinos, up in 8:2, means not simply the true, but the real, the genuine, and the veritable. It occurs elsewhere in the New Testament, only in the fourth gospel. The true, therefore, is the real archetypal representation. So in the fourth gospel, we read of the true bread coming down from heaven, or again of Christ as the truth coming down from heaven. This then is the one scheme of typology that is peculiar to the epistle. Now let me comment on this. First, the notion of shadow proves key to the typology in Hebrews. The shadowing, as Voss says, is first and foremost vertical, a shadowing down from heaven. The tabernacle on the true tabernacle, what is elethenos, shadows down the skia, the earthly. And it means that the real, the genuine, the veritable, the primordial is the image in heaven, the reality in heaven. The heavenly is the true in that it is the enduring primordial reality of itself where Christ serves in Hebrews 8:1. Now this leads us to consider the use of Exodus 25:40 and the word tupos that is found there, from which we get our word type. Listen to this. The author of Hebrews in 8:5 and 9:24 takes up the language of tupos or type in a very unique way, and I want you to hear this. Quote, "They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. For when Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, 'See that you make everything katatan tupon, according to the pattern.'" Could be literally according to the type that was shown you on the mountain. Author of Hebrews speaks similarly. "Christ has entered not into the holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself." Now, Voss notes this, and I want to make this explicit. This will help you understand what's unique to the book of Hebrews. It's not that hard, but there is an involved point here. Voss begins by noting what is standard in most New Testament uses of tupos or tupon. The latter, Paul and Peter, uniformly regard the Old Testament as the type to which the New Testament is the antitype. This is standard typological schema most readers are familiar with. This is the popular presentation most often used. The old is the type, the new is the antitype. The Old Testament realities like the tabernacle, sacrifices, and priests foreshadow the coming realities in the new. So, for instance, Paul says the Passover lamb is a type and Christ is the antitype. But the author of Hebrews, listen, reverses this schema. In Hebrews 9:24 and in Hebrews 8:5, the author of Hebrews speaks of the Old Testament as the antitype. The phrase in Hebrews 9:24, "Christ has entered not into the copies of the things that are made, but into heaven itself." What is the Greek? Antitupa tein aletheon. The copies of the heavenlies. Here, copy is the Greek word antitupa, from which we get antitype. The antitype for the author of Hebrews is therefore the earthly shadow. The thing that is a copy, hupadegmati, and a shadow. That is the antitupos, the antitype. Heaven, however, is the true, the aletheon. Heaven itself is the true. And the author of Hebrews says that the true is the tupon, the type, the pattern shown to Moses on the mountain. He's not contradicting Paul or Peter or other apostles. He's simply saying instead that the heavenly reality is the type, the earthly copy is the antitype. And Voss puts it this way. In 9:24, the author speaks of the earthly tabernacle as the antitype of the true tabernacle. This manner of speaking differs from our own and also from that of Paul and Peter. The latter uniformly regard the Old Testament as the type of which the New Testament is the antitype. This is the common New Testament usage. But the author of Hebrews, on the contrary, speaks of the Old Testament as the antitype. An antitype, of course, always has its type lying back of it as its model. To find the original type, according to Hebrews, of which the Old Testament is the antitype, we must go back to the Old Testament, to heaven. This heavenly type was shown to Moses on the mountain. That's the key phrase. In Exodus 25:40, when God showed Moses the tupon, the type or the pattern, it was the heavenly reality itself of which the earthly was a copy. So for the author of Hebrews, the type, the tupon, is the primordial heavenly model. The antitype is the earthly, shadowy copy. And this has significance for our understanding of what Moses understood. Let me put it this way. Just as Abraham looked for and desired the heavenly reality, 11:10 and 11:16, Moses saw it. That's the progression of the revelation. God revealed to Moses on the mountain the heavenly pattern and said, make everything on earth according to the heavenly exemplar, the heavenly type, the heavenly original shown to you on the mountain. The Lord opened heaven and showed Moses the archetypal reality that the tabernacle on earth would copy, hupadegmati, and shadow skia. Moses, therefore, forms a precedent among the prophets that repeats itself with Isaiah. Both are allowed to view the heavenly original, the heavenly tupon, if we use Hebrews 8:5 and the language from Hebrews 8:5. The heavenly archetype, the true tabernacle made without hands. He saw the heavenly throne. He saw the angels in worship. He saw the glory of the Lord whose robe filled the temple. And these are the pattern after which Moses was told to build the earthly copy and the earthly shadow of the tabernacle in the Old Covenant. Heaven is not merely the future goal in the Old Covenant. It is the primordial archetype, the primordial pattern after which the Old Covenant is replicated. The earthly tabernacle shadowed down heaven in order to prefigure heaven. So the vertical shadowing down is what grounds the future prefiguring. This gives us a distinct philosophy of revelation in the book of Hebrews. The earthly tabernacle, as copy and shadow of the true, always had two aspects to it, the shadowing down and the prefiguring. And the point of Hebrews, the driving point of the theology of Hebrews, is that the church has a high priest seated at the right hand of the majesty on high, serving as a minister in that true tabernacle, not made with hands, of which the mosaic was a copy and a shadow. And that means everything for the religious hope of the church, because Christ has entered heaven as prodromos, as forerunner. The forerunner who has gone into heaven in order that he might confer its joys on his church in this age and bring them where he is by faith in this age, and by sight in the age to come. And so Christ as high priest moves us inexorably now to consider his role as the forerunner who has entered behind the curtain and whose entrance behind the curtain in the holy places opens that path for the entrance of his church in union with himself.
Thank you for watching this lesson from Reformed Academy. This is just the beginning. At Reformed Academy, we offer free, in-depth courses that will help you grow in your knowledge of God's Word. Join thousands of learners from around the world who are deepening their faith and engaging with rich, redemptive historical theology, all at no cost to you. Sign up today at reformedforum.org/academy and start exploring the unfolding message of Christ revealed in all the Scriptures.